Random House Audio presents A Scanner Darkly by Philip K. Dick. Read for you by Paul Giamatti. Chapter 1. Once, a guy stood all day shaking bugs from his hair. The doctor told him there were no bugs in his hair. After taking a shower for 8 hours, standing under hot water hour after hour, suffering the pain of the bugs, he got out and dried himself, and he still had bugs in his hair. In fact, he had bugs all over him. A month later, he had bugs in his lungs. Having nothing else to do or think about, he began to work out theoretically the life cycle of the bugs, and, with the aid of the Britannica, tried to determine specifically which bugs they were, and they now filled his house. He read about many different kinds and finally noticed bugs outdoors, so he concluded they were aphids. After that decision came to his mind, it never changed, no matter what other people told him. Like, aphids don't bite people. They said that to him because the endless biting of the bugs kept him in torment. At the 7-Eleven grocery store, part of a chain spread out over most of California, he bought spray cans of Raid and Black Flag and Yard Guard. First he sprayed the house, and then himself. The Yard Guard seemed to work the best. As to the theoretical side, he perceived three stages in the cycle of the bugs. First, they were carried to him to contaminate him by what he called carrier people, which were people who didn't understand their role in distributing the bugs. During that stage, the bugs had no jaws or mandibles. He learned that word during his weeks of scholarly research, an unusually bookish occupation for a guy who worked at the handy brake and tire place relining people's brake drums. The carrier people, therefore, felt nothing. He used to sit in the far corner of his living room watching different carrier people enter, most of them people he'd known for a while, but some new to him, covered with the aphids in this particular non-biting stage. He'd sort of smile to himself, because he knew that the person was being used by the bugs and wasn't hip to it. "What are you grinning about, Jerry?" they'd say. He'd just smile. In the next stage, the bugs grew wings or something, but they really weren't precisely wings. Anyhow, they were appendages of a functional sort, permitting them to swarm, which was how they migrated and spread, especially to him. At that point, the air was full of them. It made his living room, his whole house, cloudy. During this stage, he tried not to inhale them. Most of all, he felt sorry for his dog, because he could see the bugs landing on and settling all over him and probably getting into the dog's lungs as they were at his own. Probably, at least so his empathic ability told him, the dog was suffering as much as he was. Should he give the dog away for the dog's own comfort? No, he decided. The dog was now inadvertently infected and would carry the bugs with him everywhere. Sometimes he stood in the shower with the dog, trying to wash the dog clean, too. He had no more success with him than he did with himself. It hurt to feel the dog suffer. He never stopped trying to help him. In some respect, this was the worst part, the suffering of the animal, who could not complain. "What the fuck are you doing in there all day in the shower with the goddamn dog?" his buddy Charles Freck asked one time, coming in during this. Jerry said, I gotta get the aphids off of him. He brought Max, the dog, out of the shower and began drying him. Charles Freck watched, mystified, as Jerry rubbed baby oil and talc into the dog's fur. All over the house, cans of insect spray, bottles of talc, and baby oil and skin conditioners were piled and tossed, most of them empty. He used many cans a day now.
I don't see any aphids, Charles said.
What's an aphid?
It eventually kills you, Jerry said.
That's what an aphid is. They're in my hair and my skin and my lungs. The goddamn pain is unbearable. I'm going to have to go to the hospital.
Well, how come I can't see them?
Jerry put down the dog, which was wrapped in a towel, and knelt over the shag rug.
I'll show you one, he said.
The rug was covered with aphids. They hopped up everywhere, up and down, some higher than others. He searched for an especially large one because of the difficulty people had seeing them.
Bring me a bottle or jar, he said. From under the sink. We'll cap it, put a lid on it, and then I can take it with me when I go to the doctor, and he can analyze it.
Charles Freck brought him an empty mayonnaise jar. Jerry went on searching and at last came across an aphid leaping up at least 4 feet in the air. The aphid was over an inch long. He caught it, carried it to the jar, carefully dropped it in, and screwed on the lid. Then he held it up triumphantly. "See?" he said.
"Yeah," Charles Freck said, his eyes wide as he scrutinized the contents of the jar. "What a big one. Wow."
"Help me find more for the doctor to see," Jerry said, again squatting down on the rug, the jar beside him.
"Sure," Charles Freck said, and did so.
Within half an hour, they had 3 jars full of the bugs. Charles, although new at it, found some of the largest. It was midday in June of 1994, in California, in a tract area of cheap but durable plastic houses long ago vacated by the Straits. Jerry had at an earlier date sprayed metal paint over all the windows, though, to keep out the light. The illumination for the room came from a pole lamp into which he had screwed nothing but spot lamps, which shone day and night so as to abolish time for him and his friends. He liked that. He liked to get rid of time. By doing that, he could concentrate on important things without interruption. Like this. 2 men kneeling down on the shag rug, finding bug after bug, and putting them into jar after jar.
"What do we get for these?" Charles Freck said later on in the day. "I mean, does the doctor pay a bounty or something, a prize, any bread?"
"I get to help perfect a cure for them this way," Jerry said. The pain, constant as it was, had become unbearable. He'd never gotten used to it, and he knew he never would. The urge, the longing to take another shower was overwhelming him.
"Hey, man," he gasped, straightening up. "You go on putting them in jars while I take a leak and like that."
He started toward the bathroom.
"Okay,"
Charles said, his long legs wobbling as he swung toward a jar, both hands cupped. An ex-veteran, he still had good muscular control, though. He made it to the jar. But then he said suddenly,
"Jerry, hey, those bugs sort of scare me. I don't like it here by myself."
He stood up.
"Chicken shit bastard," Jerry said, panting with pain as he halted momentarily at the bathroom. "Couldn't you?"
"I got to take a leak."
He slammed the door and spun the knobs of the shower. Water poured down.
"I'm afraid out here."
Charles Freck's voice came dimly, even though he was evidently yelling loud.
"Then go fuck yourself,"
Jerry yelled back and stepped into the shower. What fucking good are friends? He asked himself bitterly. No good. No good. No fucking good.
"These fuckers sting,"
Charles yelled right at the door.
"Yeah, they sting,"
Jerry said as he rubbed shampoo into his hair.
"That's what I thought."
A pause.
"Can I wash my hands and get them off and wait for you?" Chicken shit,
Jerry thought with bitter fury. He said nothing. He merely kept on washing.
That bastard wasn't worth answering.
He paid no attention to Charles Freck, only to himself, to his own vital, demanding, terrible, urgent needs. Everything else would have to wait. There was no time. No time. These things could not be postponed. Everything else was secondary.
Except the dog.
He wondered about Max, the dog. Charles Freck phoned up somebody who he hoped was holding.
"Can you lay about 10 deaths on me?"
"Christ, I'm entirely out. I'm looking to score myself. And let me know when you find some. I could use some."
"And what's wrong with the supply?"
"Some busts, I guess."
Charles Freck hung up and then ran a fantasy number in his head as he slumped dismally back from the payphone booth. You never used your home phone for a buy call. To his parked Chevy. In his fantasy number, he was driving past the thrifty drugstore and they had a huge window display. Bottles of slow death, cans of slow death, jars and bathtubs and vats and bowls of slow death, millions of caps and tabs and hits of slow death mixed with speed and junk and barbiturates and psychedelics, everything. And a giant sign.
"Your credit is good here."
Not to mention, low, low prices, lowest in town. But in actuality, the thrifty usually had a display of nothing. Combs, bottles of mineral oil, spray cans of deodorant, always crap like that. But I bet the pharmacy in the back has slow death under lock and key in an unstepped-on, pure, unadulterated, uncut form, he thought as he drove from the parking lot onto Harbor Boulevard into the afternoon traffic.
Bet a
50-pound bag. He wondered when and how they unloaded the 50-pound bag of Substance D at the Thrifty Pharmacy every morning, from wherever it came from. God knew, maybe from Switzerland, or maybe from another planet where some wise race lived. They'd deliver probably real early, and with armed guards. The man standing there with laser rifles looking mean, the way the man always did. "Anybody rip off my slow death?" he thought through the man's head. "I'll snuff them." Probably Substance D is an ingredient in every legal medication that's worth anything, he thought. A little pinch here and there, according to the secret exclusive formula the issuing house in Germany or Switzerland that invented it. But in actuality, he knew better. The authorities snuffed or sent up everybody selling or transporting or using. So in that case, the Thrifty drugstore, all the millions of Thrifty drugstores, would get shot or bombed out of business or anyhow fined. More likely just fined. The Thrifty had pull. Anyhow, how do you shoot a chain of big drugstores or put them away? Well, they just got ordinary stuff, he thought as he cruised along. He felt lousy because he only had 300 tabs of slow death left in his stash, buried in his backyard under his camellia, the hybrid one with the cool big blossoms that didn't burn brown in the spring. I only got a week's supply, he thought. What then when I'm out? Shit. Suppose everybody in California and parts of Oregon runs out the same day, he thought. Wow. This was the all-time winning horror fantasy that he ran in his head, that every doper ran. The whole western part of the United States simultaneously running out and everybody crashing on the same day, probably about 6 a.m. Sunday morning, while the straights were getting dressed up to go to fucking pray. Scene. The First Episcopal Church of Pasadena at 8:30 a.m. on Crash Sunday. Holy parishioners, let us call on God now at this time to request his intervention in the agonies of those who are thrashing about on their beds withdrawing. Yeah, yeah, the congregation agreeing with the priest. But before he intervenes with a fresh supply of... A black and white evidently had noticed something in Charles Freck's driving he hadn't noticed. It had taken off from its parking spot and was moving along behind him in traffic, so far without lights or sirens, but... Maybe I'm weaving or something, he thought. Fucking goddamn fuzzmobile saw me fucking up. I wonder what. Cop. All right, what's your name? My name? Can't think of name. You don't know your own name? Cop signals to other cop in prowl car. This guy's really spaced. Don't shoot me here. Charles Freck and his horror fantasy number induced by the sight of the black and white pacing him. At least take me to the station house and shoot me there, out of sight. To survive in this fascist police state, he thought, you gotta always be able to come up with a name, your name, at all times. That's the first sign they look for that you're wired, not being able to figure out who the hell you are. What I'll do, he decided, is I'll pull off soon as I see a parking slot, pull off voluntarily before he flashes his light or does anything, and then when he glides up beside me, I'll say I got a loose wheel or something mechanical. They always think that's great, he thought, when you give up like that and can't go on. Like throwing yourself on the ground the way an animal does, exposing your soft, unprotected, defenseless underbelly. I'll do that, he thought. He did so, peeling off to the right and bumping the front wheels of his car against the curb. The cop car went on by. Pulled off for nothing, he thought. Now it'll be hard to back out again, traffic's so heavy. He shut off his engine. Maybe I'll just sit here parked for a while, he decided, and alpha meditate or go into various different altered states of consciousness, possibly by watching the chicks going along on foot. I wonder if they manufacture bioscope for horny, rather than alpha. Horny waves, first very short, then longer, larger, larger, finally right off the scale. This is getting me nowhere, he realized. I should be out trying to locate someone holding. I gotta get my supply, or pretty soon I'll be freaking, and then I won't be able to do anything, even sit at the curb like I am. I not only won't know who I am, I won't even know where I am or what's happening. What is happening? He asked himself. What day is this? If I knew what day, I'd know everything else. And it'd seep back bit by bit. Wednesday, in downtown L.A., the Westwood section. Ahead, One of those giant shopping malls surrounded by a wall that you bounced off like a rubber ball, unless you had a credit card on you and passed in through the electronic hoop. Owning no credit card for any of the malls, it could depend only on a verbal report as to what the shops were like inside. A whole bunch, evidently, selling good products to the straights, especially to the straight wives. He watched the uniformed armed guards at the mall gate checking out each person. Seeing that the man or woman matched his or her credit card and that it hadn't been ripped off, sold, bought, used fraudulently. Lots of people moved on in through the gate, but he figured many were no doubt window shopping. Not all that many people can have the bread or the urge to buy this time of day, he reflected. It's early, just past 2. At night, that was when. Shops all lit up. He could, all the brothers and sisters could, see the lights from without like showers of sparks, like a fun park for grown-up kids. Stores this side of the mall, requiring no credit card with no armed guards, didn't amount to much. Utility stores, a shoe and a TV shop, a bakery, small appliance repair, a laundromat. He watched a girl who wore a short plastic jacket and stretch pants wander along from store to store. She had nice hair, but he couldn't see her face, see if she was foxy. Not a bad figure, he thought. The girl stopped for a time at a window where leather goods were displayed. She was checking out a purse with tassels. He could see her peering, worrying, scheming on the purse. Bet she goes on in and requests to see it, he thought. The girl bopped on into the store, as he had figured. Another girl amid the sidewalk traffic came along, this one in a frilly blouse, high heels, with silver hair and too much makeup. Trying to look older than she is, he thought. Probably not out of high school. After her came nothing worth mentioning, so he removed the string that held the glove compartment shut and got out a pack of cigarettes. He lit up and turned on the car radio to a rock station. Once he had owned a tape cartridge stereo, but finally, while loaded one day, he had neglected to bring it indoors with him when he locked up the car. Naturally, when he returned, the whole stereo tape system had been stolen. As would carelessness get you, he'd thought, and so now he had only the crummy radio. Someday, they'd take that too. But he knew where he could get another for almost nothing, used. Anyhow, the car stood to be wrecked any day. Its oil rings were shot and compression had dropped way down. Evidently, he had burned a valve on the freeway coming home one night with a whole bunch of good stuff. Sometimes when he'd really scored heavy, he got paranoid. Not about the cops so much as about some other heads ripping him off. Some head desperate from withdrawing and dingy as a motherfucker. A girl walked along now that made him take notice. Black hair, pretty, cruising slow. She wore an open midriff blouse and denim white pants, washed a lot. Hey, I know her, he thought. That's Bob Arctor's girl. That's Donna. He pushed open the car door and stepped out. The girl eyed him and continued on. He followed. She thinks I'm fixing to grab ass, he thought as he snaked among the people. How easily she gained speed. He could barely see her now as she glanced back. A firm, calm face. He saw large eyes that appraised him, calculated his speed and would he catch up. Not at this rate, he thought. She can really move. At the corner, people had halted for the sign to say walk instead of don't walk. Cars were making wild left turns. But the girl continued on, fast but with dignity, threading her path among the nutto cars. The drivers glared at her with indignation. She didn't appear to notice. Donna! When the sign flashed walk, he hurried across after her and caught up with her. She declined to run, but merely walked rapidly. Aren't you Bob's, old lady? He said. He managed to get in front of her to examine her face. No, she said. No. She came toward him, directly at him. He retreated backward because she held a short knife pointed at his stomach. Get lost, she said, continuing to move forward without slowing or hesitating. Sure you are, he said. I met you at his place. He could hardly see the knife, only a tiny section of blade metal, but he knew it was there. She would stab him and walk on. The girl held the knife so well concealed that probably no one else, the others walking along, could notice. But he did. It was going right at him as she approached without hesitation. He stepped aside then, and the girl traveled on in silence.
Jeez, he said to the back of her. I know it's Donna, he thought. She just doesn't flash in who I am, that she knows me. Scared, I guess. Scared I'm going to hustle her. You got to be careful, he thought. When you come to a strange chick on the street, they're all prepared now. Too much has happened to them.
Funky little knife, he thought. Chicks shouldn't carry those. Any guy could turn her wrist and the blade back on her any time he wanted. I could have, if I really wanted to get her. He stood there feeling angry. I know that was Donna, he thought. As he started to go back toward his parked car, he realized that the girl had halted out of the movement of passers-by and now stood silently gazing at him. He walked cautiously toward her.
One night, he said, me and Bob and another chick had some old Simon and Garfunkel tapes, and you were sitting there.
She had been filling capsules with high-grade death one by one, painstakingly, for over an hour. El primo, numero uno, death. After she had finished, she'd laid a cap on each of them, and they had dropped them, all of them together. Except her.
I just sell them, she had said. If I start dropping them, I eat up all my profits.
The girl said,
I thought you were going to knock me down and bang me.
No, he said. I just wondered if you...
He hesitated.
Like, wanted a ride.
On the sidewalk? He said, startled. In broad daylight?
Maybe in a doorway, or pull me into a car.
I know you, he protested. An Arctur would snuff me if I did that.
Well, I didn't recognize you.
She came toward him three steps.
I'm sort of nearsighted.
Oh, you ought to wear contacts.
She had, he thought, lovely, large, dark, warm eyes, which meant she wasn't on junk.
I did have, but one fell out in a punch bowl. Acid punch at a party. It sank to the bottom. I guess someone dipped it up and drank it. I hope it tasted good. It cost me $35 originally.
You want to ride where you're going?
He'll bang me in the car.
No,
he said.
I can't get it on right now these last couple of weeks. It must be something they're adulterating all the stuff with, some chemical.
That's a neato line, but I've heard it before. Everybody bangs me.
She amended that.
Tries to, anyhow. That's what it's like to be a chick. I'm suing one guy in court right now for molestation and assault. We're asking punitive damages in excess of $40,000.
And how far did he get?
Donna said,
got his hand around my boob.
Well, that isn't worth $40,000.
Together they walked back toward his car.
You got anything to sell?
He asked.
I'm really hurting. I'm virtually out, in fact. Hell, I am out, come to think of it. Even a few, if you could spare a few.
I can get you some.
Tabs, he said. I don't shoot up.
Yes, she nodded intently, head down. But, see, they're real scarce right now. The supply's temporarily dried up. You probably discovered that already. I can't get you very many, but...
When?
He broke in. They'd reached his car. He halted, opened the door, got in. On the far side, Donna got in. They sat side by side.
Day after tomorrow, Donna said. If I can get a hold of this guy, I think I can.
Shit, he thought. Day after tomorrow. No sooner, not like day tonight.
Tomorrow at the earliest.
How much?
$60, $100.
Oh, jeez, he said. That's a burn.
They're super good. I've got them from them before. They're really not what you usually buy into. Take my word for it. They're worth it. Actually, I prefer to get them from him rather than from anybody else when I can. He doesn't always have them. See, he just took a trip down south, I guess. He just got back. He picked them up himself, so I know they're good, for sure. And you don't have to pay me in advance when I get them, okay? I trust you.
I never front, he said.
Sometimes you have to.
Okay, he said. Now can you get me at least 100?
He tried to figure rapidly how many he could get. In 2 days, he could probably raise $120 and get 200 tabs from her. And if he ran across a better deal in the meantime from other people who were holding, he could forget her deal and buy from them. That was the advantage of never fronting. That plus never being burned.
It's lucky for you that you ran into me,
Donna said as he started up his car and backed out into traffic.
I'm supposed to see this one dude in about an hour, and he'd probably take all I could get. He'd have been out of luck. This was your day.
She smiled, and he did too.
I wish you could get him sooner, he said.
If I do,
Opening her purse, she got out a little notepad and a pen that had Spark's battery tune-up stamped on it. How do I get a hold of you? And I forget your name.
Charles B. Freck, he said.
He told her his phone number. Not his, really, but the one he made use of at a straight friend's house for messages like this. And laboriously she wrote it down.
What difficulty she had writing, he thought,
peering and slowly scrawling.
They don't teach the chicks jack shit in school anymore, he thought. Flat out illiterate. But Foxy? So she can't hardly read or write. So what? What matters with a fox is nice tits.
I think I remember you, Donna said. Sort of. It's all hazy that night. I was really out of it. All I definitely remember was getting the powder into those little caps, Librium caps. We dumped the original contents. I must have dropped half. I mean, on the floor. She gazed at him meditatively as he drove. You seem like a mellow dude, she said. And you'll be in the market later on? After a while you'll want more?
Sure, he said,
wondering to himself if he could beat her price by the time he saw her again. He felt he could, most likely. Either way, he won. That is, either way, he scored.
Happiness, he thought, is knowing you got some bills.
The day outside the car and all the busy people, the sunlight and activity streamed past unnoticed. He was happy. Look what he had found by chance, because, in fact, a black and white had accidentally paced him. An unexpected new supply of Substance D. What more could he ask out of life? He could probably now count on 2 weeks lying ahead of him, nearly half a month before he croaked, or nearly croaked. Withdrawing from Substance D made the two the same. 2 weeks! His heart soared, and he smelled for a moment, coming in from the open windows of the car, the brief excitement of spring.
Want to go with me to see Jerry Fabin?
He asked the girl.
I'm taking a load of his things over to him at the No. 3 Federal Clinic where they took him last night. I'm just carting over a little at a time, because there's a chance he might get back out, and I don't want to have to drag it all back.
I better not see him, Donna said.
You know him, Jerry Fabin?
Jerry Fabin thinks I contaminated him originally with those bugs.
Aphids.
Well, then he didn't know what they were. No, I'd better stay away. Last time I saw him, he got really hostile. It's his receptor sites in his brain, at least I think so. It seems like it, from what the government pamphlets say now.
That can't be restored, can it?
He said. No, Donna said, that's irreversible.
Well, the clinic people said they'd let me see him, and they said they believed he could work some, you know, he gestured. Not be,
Again he gestured. It was hard to find words for that, what he was trying to say about his friend. Glancing at him, Donna said, You don't have speech center damage, do you? In your, what is it called, occipital lobe?
No,
he said, vigorously. Do you have any kind of damage? She tapped her head.
No, it's just, you know, I have trouble saying it about those fucking clinics. I hate the neural aphasia clinics. One time I was there visiting a guy. He was trying to wax a floor. They said he couldn't wax a floor. I mean, he couldn't figure out how to do it. But what got me was he kept trying. I mean, not just for like an hour. He was still trying a month later when I came back. Just like he had been over and over again when I first saw him there, when I first went to visit him. He couldn't figure out why he couldn't get it right. I remember the look on his face. He was sure he'd get it right if he kept trying to flash on what he was doing wrong. What am I doing wrong? He kept asking him. There was no way to tell him. I mean, they told him. Hell, I told him. But he still couldn't figure it out.
The receptor sites in his brain are what I've heard usually goes first, Donna said placidly. Someone's brain, where he's gotten a bad hit or like that, like too heavy. She was watching the cars ahead. Oh, look, there's one of those new Porsches with two engines, she pointed excitedly.
Wow. I knew a guy who hotwired one of those new Porsches, he said, and got it out on the Riverside Freeway and pushed it up to 175. Wipe out, he gestured. Right into the ass of a semi. Never saw it, I guess.
In his head, he ran a fantasy number, himself, at the wheel of a Porsche, but noticing the sunlight, all the sunlight, and everyone on the freeway, the Hollywood freeway at rush hour, noticing him. Noticing him for sure, a lanky, big-shouldered, good-looking dude in the new Porsche, going 200 miles an hour, and all the cops' faces hanging open helplessly. "You're shaking," Donna said. She reached over and put her hand on his arm, a quiet hand that he had once responded to. "Slow down."
"I'm tired," he said. "I was up two nights and 2 days counting bugs, counting them and putting them in bottles. And finally, when we crashed and got up and got ready the next morning to put the bottles in the car to take to the doctor to show him, there was nothing in the bottles. Empty."
He could feel the shaking now himself and see it in his hands on the wheel, the shaking hands on the steering wheel at 20 miles an hour.
"Every fucking one," he said. "Nothing, no bugs. And then I fucking realized it came to me about his brain, Jerry's brain."
The air no longer smelled of spring, and he thought, abruptly, that he urgently needed a hit of Substance D. It was later in the day than he had realized, or else he had taken less than he thought. Fortunately, he had his portable supply with him, in the glove compartment, way back. He began searching for a vacant parking slot to pull over. "Your mind plays tricks," Donna said remotely. She seemed to have withdrawn into herself, gone far away. He wondered if his erratic driving was bumming her. Probably so. Another fantasy film rolled suddenly into his head, without his consent. He saw first a big parked Pontiac with a bumper jack on the back of it that was slipping, and a kid around 13 with long thatched hair struggling to hold the car from rolling, meanwhile yelling for assistance. He saw himself and Jerry Fabin running out of the house together, Jerry's house, down the beer can littered driveway to the car. Himself, he grabbed at the car door on the driver's side to open it to stomp the brake pedal. But Jerry Fabin, wearing only his pants without even shoes, his hair all disarranged and streaming, he had been sleeping. Jerry ran past the car to the back and knocked, with his bare pale shoulder that never saw the light of day, the boy entirely away from the car. The jack bent and fell, the rear of the car crashed down, the tire and wheel rolled away, and the boy was okay. "Too late for the brake," Jerry panted, trying to get his ugly greasy hair from his eyes and blinking. "No time."
"Is he okay?"
Charles Freck yelled, his heart still pounded.
"Yeah."
Jerry stood by the boy, gasping.
"Shit,"
he yelled at the boy in fury.
"Didn't I tell you to wait until we were doing it with you? And when a bumper jack slips, shit, man, you can't hold back 5,000 pounds.
His face writhed. The boy, little rat-ass, looked miserable and twitched guiltily.
"I repeatedly and repeatedly told you."
I went for the brake,"
Charles Freck explained, knowing his idiocy. His own equal fuck-up, great as the boy's and equally lethal. His failure as a full-grown man to respond right. But he wanted to justify it anyhow, as the boy did, in words.
"But now I realize,"
he yammered on, and then the fantasy number broke off. It was a documentary rerun, actually. Because he remembered the day when this had happened, back when they were all living together. Jerry's good instinct. Otherwise, Rat-Ass would have been under the back of the Pontiac, his spine smashed. The three of them plodded gloomily back toward the house, not even chasing the tire and wheel, which was still rolling off.
"I was asleep," Jerry muttered as they entered the dark interior of the house. "It's the first time in a couple of weeks the bugs let up enough so I could. I haven't gotten any sleep at all for 5 days. I've been running and running. I thought that they were maybe gone. They've been gone. I thought that they finally gave up and went somewhere else, like next door, and out of the house entirely. Now I can feel them again. The 10th no-pest trip I got, or maybe it's the 11th, they cheated me again, like they did with all the others."
But his voice was subdued now, not angry, just low and perplexed. He put his hand on Rat-Ass's head and gave him a sharp smack.
"You dumb kid. When a bumper jack slips, get the hell out of there. Forget the car. Don't ever get behind it and try to push back against all that mass and block it with your body."
"But, Jerry, I was afraid the axle..."
"Fuck the axle. Fuck the car. It's your life."
They passed on through the dark living room, the three of them, and the rerun of a now-gone moment winked out and died forever. Chapter 2
"Gentlemen of the Anaheim Lions Club," the man at the microphone said, "we have a wonderful opportunity this afternoon, for you see, the County of Orange has provided us with the chance to hear from, and then put questions to and of, an undercover narcotics agent from the Orange County Sheriff's Department."
He beamed, this man wearing his pink waffle fiber suit and wide plastic yellow tie and blue shirt and fake leather shoes. He was an overweight man, overaged as well, overhappy, even when there was little or nothing to be happy about. Watching him, the undercover narcotics agent felt nausea.
"Now, you will notice," the Lions Club host said, "that you can barely see this individual, who is seated directly to my right, because he is wearing what is called a scramble suit, which is the exact same suit he wears, and in fact must wear, during certain parts, in fact most, of his daily activities of law enforcement. Later, he will explain why."
The audience, which mirrored the qualities of the host in every possible way, regarded the individual in his scramble suit.
"This man," the host declared, "whom we will call Fred, because this is the code name under which he reports the information he gathers, once within the scramble suit, cannot be identified by voice or even by technological voice print, or by appearance. But he looks, does he not, like a vague blur and nothing more? Am I right?"
He let loose a great smile. His audience, appreciating that this was indeed funny, did a little smiling on their own. The scramble suit was an invention of the Bell Laboratories, conjured up by accident by an employee named S.A. Powers. He had, a few years ago, been experimenting with disinhibiting substances affecting neural tissue, and one night, having administered to himself an IV injection considered safe and mildly euphoric, had experienced a disastrous drop in the GABA fluid of his brain. Subjectively, he had then witnessed lurid phosphine activity projected on the far wall of his bedroom, a frantically progressing montage of what, at the time, he imagined to be modern-day abstract paintings. For about 6 hours, entranced, S.A. Powers had watched thousands of Picasso paintings replace one another at flash-cut speed, and then he had been treated to Paul Klee, more than the painter had painted during his entire lifetime. S.A. Powers, now viewing Modigliani paintings replace themselves at furious velocity, had conjectured, one needs a theory for everything, that the Rosicrucians were telepathically beaming pictures at him, probably boosted by micro-relay systems of an advanced order. But then, when Kandinsky paintings began to harass him, he recalled that the main art museum at Leningrad specialized in just such non-objective moderns, and decided that the Soviets were attempting telepathically to contact him. In the morning, he remembered that a drastic drop in the GABA fluid of the brain normally produced such phosphine activity. Nobody was trying, telepathically, with or without microwave boosting, to contact him. But it did give him the idea for the scramble suit. Basically, his design consisted of a multi-faced quartz lens hooked to a miniaturized computer whose memory banks held up to 1.5 million physiognomic fraction representations of various people, men and women, children, with every variant encoded and then projected outward in all directions equally onto a super-thin, shroud-like membrane large enough to fit around an average human. As the computer looped through its banks, it projected every conceivable eye color, hair color, shape and type of nose, formation of teeth, configuration of facial bone structure. The entire shroud-like membrane took on whatever physical characteristics were projected at any nanosecond, and then switched to the next. Just to make his scramble suit more effective, S.A. Powers programmed the computer to randomize the sequence of characteristics within each set. And to bring the cost down, the federal people always like that, he found the source for the material of the membrane in a byproduct of a large industrial firm already doing business with Washington. In any case, the wearer of a scramble suit was every man, and in every combination up to combinations of 1.5 million sub-bits during the course of each hour. Hence, any description of him or her was meaningless. Needless to say, S.A. Powers had fed his own personal physiognomic characteristics into the computer units, so that, buried in the frantic permutation of qualities, his own surfaced and combined. On an average, he had calculated, of once each 50 years pursuit, served up and reassembled, given enough time pursuit. It was his closest claim to immortality. "Let's hear it for the vague blur," the host said loudly, and there was mass clapping. In his scramble suit, Fred, who was also Robert Arctor, groaned and thought, "This is terrible." Once a month, an undercover narcotics agent of the county was assigned at random to speak before bubblehead gatherings such as this. Today was his turn. Looking at his audience, he realized how much he detested straights. They thought this was all great. They were smiling. They were being entertained. Maybe at this moment the virtually countless components of his scramble suit had served up S.A. Powers. "But to be serious for just a moment," the host said, "this man here..." He paused, trying to remember. "Fred," Bob Arctor said. "S.A. Fred." "Fred, yes." The host, invigorated, resumed, booming in the direction of his audience. "You see, Fred's voice is like one of those robot computer voices down in San Diego at the bank when you drive in. Perfectly toneless and artificial. It leaves in our minds no characteristics, exactly as when he reports to his superiors in the Orange County Drug Abuse, program." He paused meaningfully. "You see, there is a dire risk for these police officers because the forces of dope, as we know, have penetrated with amazing skill into the various law enforcement apparatuses throughout our nation, or may well have, according to most informed experts. So for the protection of these dedicated men, this scramble suit is necessary." Slight applause for the scramble suit, and then expectant gazes at Fred, lurking within its membrane. "But in his line of work in the field," the host added finally, as he moved away from the microphone to make room for Fred, "he, of course, does not wear this. He dresses like you or I, although, of course, in the hippie garb of those of the various subculture groups within which he bores in tireless fashion." He motioned to Fred to rise and approach the microphone. Fred, Robert Arctor, had done this 6 times before, and he knew what to say and what was in store for him. The assorted degrees and kinds of asshole questions and opaque stupidity. The waste of time for him out of this, plus anger on his part and a sense of futility each time, and always more so. "If you saw me on the street," he said into the microphone after the applause had died out, "you'd say, 'There goes a weirdo freak doper,' and you'd feel aversion and walk away." Silence. "I don't look like you," he said. "I can't afford to. My life depends on it." Actually, he did not look that different from them, and anyhow, he would have worn what he wore daily anyhow, job or not, life or not. He liked what he wore. But what he was saying had, by and large, been written by others and put before him to memorize. He could depart some, but they all had a standard format they used. Introduced a couple of years ago by a gung-ho division chief, it had by now become writ. He waited while that sank in. "I'm not going to tell you first," he said, "what I am attempting to do as an undercover officer engaged in tracking down dealers and most of all the source of their illegal drugs in the streets of our cities and corridors of our schools here in Orange County. I am going to tell you," he paused as they had trained him to do in PR class at the academy, "what I am afraid of," he finished. That gaffed them. They had become all eyes. "What I fear," he said, "night and day, is that our children, your children and my children..." Again he paused. "I have too," he said, then extra quietly, "little ones, very little." And then he raised his voice emphatically. "But not too little to be addicted, calculatedly addicted for profit by those who would destroy this society." Another pause. "We do not know as yet," he continued presently, more calmly, "specifically who these men, or rather animals, are, who prey on our young, as if in a wild jungle abroad, as in some foreign country, not ours. The identity of the purveyors of the poisons concocted of brain-destructive filth, shot daily, orally taken daily, smoked daily by several million men and women, or rather that were once men and women, is gradually being unraveled. But finally we will, before God, know for sure." A voice from the audience. "Sock it to 'em!" Another voice, equally enthusiastic. "Get the commies!" Applause and reprise severally. Robert Arctor halted.
stared at them, at the straits in their fat suits, their fat ties, their fat shoes, and he thought, Substance D can't destroy their brains. They have none.
Tell it like it is,
a slightly less emphatic voice called up, a woman's voice. Searching, Arctor made out a middle-aged lady, not so fat, her hands clasped anxiously.
Each day, Fred, Robert Arctor, whatever, said, this disease takes its toll of us. By the end of each passing day, the flow of profits, and where they go, we...
He broke off. For the life of him, he could not dredge up the rest of the sentence, even though he had repeated it a million times, both in class and at previous lectures. All in the large room had fallen silent.
Well, he said, it isn't the profits, anyhow. It's something else. What you see happen.
They didn't notice any difference, he noticed, even though he had dropped the prepared speech and was wandering on by himself without help from the PR boys back at the Orange County Civic Center.
What difference, anyhow, he thought. So what? What really do they know or care?
The Straits, he thought, live in their fortified huge apartment complexes guarded by their guards, ready to open fire on any and every doper who scales the wall with an empty pillowcase to rip off their piano and electric clock and razor and stereo that they haven't paid for anyhow, so he can get his fix, get the shit that if he doesn't, he maybe dies, outright flat-out dies of the pain and shock of withdrawal. But, he thought, when you're living inside looking safely out and your wall is electrified and your guard is armed, why think about that? If you were a diabetic, he said, and you didn't have money for a hit of insulin, would you steal to get the money, or just die? Silence. In the headphone of his scramble suit, a tinny voice said, I think you better go back to the prepared text, Fred. I really do advise it. Into his throat mic, Fred, Robert Arctor, whatever, said, I forget it. Only his superior to Orange County GHQ, which was not Mr. F., that is to say Hank, could hear this. This was an anonymous superior assigned to him only for this occasion.
Right, the official Timmy prompter said in his earphone. I'll read it to you. Repeat it after me, but try to get it to sound casual.
Slight hesitation, riffling of pages.
Let's see. Each day the profits flow. Where they go, we, that's about where you stopped.
I got a block against this stuff, Arctor said.
We'll soon determine, his official prompter said, unheeding. And then retribution will swiftly follow, and at that moment I would not for the life of me be in their shoes.
Do you know why I've got a block against this stuff? Arctor said. Because this is what gets people on dope. He thought, this is why you lurch off and become a doper, this sort of stuff. This is why you give up and leave. In disgust. But then he looked once more out at his audience and realized that for them, this was not so. This was the only way they could be reached. He was talking to nitwits, mental simps. It had to be put in the same way it had been put in first grade. A is for apple, and the apple is round.
D, he said aloud to his audience, is for substance D, which is for dumbness and despair and desertion, the desertion of your friends from you, you from them, everyone from everyone, isolation and loneliness and hating and suspecting each other. D, he said then, it's finally death. Slow death, we... He halted.
We the dopers, he said, call it. His voice rasped and faltered.
As you probably know, slow death from the head on down.
Well, that's it. He walked back to his chair and reseated himself in silence.
You blow it, his superior, the prompter, said. See me in my office when you get back, room 430.
Yes, Arctor said. I blew it. They were looking at him as if he had pissed on the stage before their eyes, although he was not sure just why. Striding to the mic, the Lions Club host said,
Fred asked me in advance of this lecture to make it primarily a question-and-answer forum, with only a short introductory statement by him. I forgot to mention that.
All right.
He raised his right hand.
Who first, people?
Arctor suddenly got to his feet again, clumsily.
It would appear that Fred has something more to add,
the host said, beckoning to him. Going slowly back over to the microphone, Arctor said, his head down, speaking with precision,
Just this.
don't kick their asses after they're on it. The users, the addicts. Half of them, most of them, especially the girls, didn't know what they were getting on, or even that they were getting on anything at all. Just try to keep them, the people, any of us, from getting on it. He looked up briefly. See, they dissolve some reds in a glass of wine, the pushers, I mean. They give the booze to a chick, an underage little chick with 8 to 10 reds in it, and she passes out, and then they inject her with a Mex hit, which is half heroin and half substance D. He broke off. Thank you, he said. A man called up. How do we stop them, sir? Kill the pushers, Arctor said, and walked back to his chair. He did not feel like returning right away to the Orange County Civic Center and room 430, so he wandered down one of the commercial streets of Anaheim, inspecting the McDonald burger stands and car washes and gas stations and Pizza Huts and other marvels. Roaming aimlessly along like this on the public street with all kinds of people, he always had a strange feeling as to who he was. As he'd said to the Lions types there in the hall, he looked like a doper when out of his scramble suit. He conversed like a doper. Those around him now no doubt took him to be a doper and reacted accordingly. Other dopers, see there, he thought, other, for instance, gave him a peace, brother, look, and the straights didn't. You put on a bishop's robe and a mitre, he pondered, and you walk around like that, and people bow and genuflect and like that, and try to kiss your ring, if not your ass, and pretty soon you're a bishop, so to speak. What is identity? He asked himself. Where does the act end? Nobody knows. What really fouled up his sense of who and what he was came when the man hassled him. When harness bulls, beat cops, or cops in general, any and all, for example, came cruising up slowly to the curb near him in an intimidating manner as he walked, scrutinized him at length with an intense, keen, metallic, blank stare, and then, often as not, evidently on whim, parked and beckoned him over. Okay, let's see your ID, the cop would say, reaching out, and then, as Arctor Fred whatever God knew fumbled in his wallet pocket, the cop would yell at him, ever been arrested? Or, as a variant on that, adding, before? As if he were about to go into the bucket right then. What's the beef? He usually said, if he said anything at all. A crowd naturally gathered. Most of them assumed he'd been nailed dealing on the corner. They grinned uneasily and waited to see what happened, although some of them, usually Chicanos or blacks or obvious heads, looked angry. And those that looked angry began after a short interval to be aware that they looked angry, and they changed that swiftly to impassive, because everybody knew that anyone looking angry or uneasy, it didn't matter which, around cops must have something to hide. The cops especially knew that, legend had it, and they hassled such persons automatically. This time, however, no one bothered him. Many heads were in evidence. He was only one of many. What am I, actually? He asked himself. He wished momentarily for his scramble suit. Then he thought, I could go on being a vague blur, and passers-by, street people in general, would applaud. Let's hear it for the vague blur, he thought, doing a short rerun. What a way to get recognition. How, for instance, could they be sure it wasn't some other vague blur, and not the right one? It could be somebody other than Fred inside, or another Fred, and they'd never know, not even when Fred opened his mouth and talked. They wouldn't really know then. They'd never know. It could be Al pretending to be Fred, for example. It could be anyone in there. It could even be empty. Down at Orange County GHQ, they could be piping a voice to the scramble suit, animating it from the sheriff's office. Fred could in that case be anybody who happened to be at his desk that day and happened to pick up the script and the mic. Or a composite of all sorts of guys at their desks. But I guess what I said at the end, he thought, finishes off that. That wasn't anybody back in the office. The guys in the office want to talk to me about that, as a matter of fact. He didn't look forward to that, so he continued to loiter and delay, going nowhere, going everywhere. In Southern California, it didn't make any difference anyhow where you went. It was always the same McDonald burger place over and over, like a circular strip that turned past you as you pretended to go somewhere. And finally, when you got hungry and went to the McDonald burger place and bought a McDonald's hamburger, it was the one they sold you last time, and the time before that, and so forth, back to before you were born. And in addition, bad people, liars, They said it was made out of turkey gizzards anyhow. They had by now, according to their sign, sold the same original burger 50 billion times. He wondered if it was to the same person. Life in Anaheim, California was a commercial for itself, endlessly replayed. Nothing changed. It just spread out farther and farther in the form of neon ooze. What there was always more of had been congealed into permanence long ago, as if the automatic factory that cranked out these objects had jammed in the on position. How the land became plastic, he thought, remembering the fairy tale, how the sea became salt. Someday, he thought, it'll be mandatory that we all sell the McDonald's hamburger as well as buy it. We'll sell it back and forth to each other forever from our living rooms. That way we won't even have to go outside. He looked at his watch. 2:30. Time to make a buy call. According to Donna, he could score through her on perhaps 1,000 tabs of Substance D cut with meth. Naturally, once he got it, he would turn it over to County Drug Abuse to be analyzed and then destroyed, or whatever they did with it. Dropped it themselves, maybe, or so another legend went. Or sold it. But his purchase from her was not to bust her for dealing. He had bought many times from her and had never arrested her. That was not what it was all about, busting a small-time local dealer, a chick who considered it cool and far out to deal dope. Half the narcotics agents in Orange County were aware that Donna dealt and recognized her on sight. Donna dealt sometimes in the parking lot of the 7-Eleven store, in front of the automatic hollow scanner the police kept going there, and got away with it. In a sense, Donna could never be busted, no matter what she did and in front of whom. What his transaction with Donna, like all those before, added up to was an attempt to thread a path upward via Donna to the supplier she bought from, so his purchases from her gradually grew in quantity. Originally, he had coaxed her, if that was the word, into laying 10 tabs on him, as a favor. Friend-to-friend stuff. Then later on, he had wangled a bag of 100 for recompense, then 3 bags. Now, if he lucked out, he could score 1,000, which was 10 bags. Eventually, he would be buying in a quantity which would be beyond her economic capacity. She could not front enough bread for her supplier to secure the stuff at her end. Therefore, she would lose instead of getting a big profit. They would haggle. She would insist that he front at least part of it. He would refuse. She couldn't front it herself to her source. Time would run out. Even in a deal that small, a certain amount of tension would grow. Everyone would be getting impatient. Her supplier, whoever he was, would be holding and mad because she hadn't shown. So eventually, if it worked out right, she would give up and say to him and to her supplier, "Look, you better deal direct with each other. I know you both. You're both cool. I'll vouch for both of you. I'll set a place and a time, and you two can meet. So, from now on, Bob, you can start buying direct, if you're going to buy in this quantity." Because in that quantity, he was, for all intents and purposes, a dealer. These were approaching dealer's quantities. Donna would assume he was reselling at a profit per 100, since he was buying 1,000 at a time, at least. This way, he could travel up the ladder and come to the next person in line. Become a dealer like her, and then later on, maybe get another step up, and another, as the quantities he bought grew. Eventually, this was the name of the project, he would meet someone high enough to be worth busting. That meant someone who knew something, which meant someone either in contact with those who manufactured, or someone who ran it in from the supplier who himself knew the source. Unlike other drugs, Substance D had, apparently, only one source. It was synthetic, not organic. Therefore, it came from a lab. It could be synthesized, and already had been in federal experiments. But the constituents were themselves derived from complex substances almost equally difficult to synthesize. Theoretically, it could be manufactured by anyone who had first the formula and second the technological capacity to set up a factory. But in practice, the cost was out of reach. Also, those who had invented it and were making it available sold it too cheaply for effective competition. And the wide distribution suggested that even though a sole source existed, it had a diversified layout, probably a series of labs in several key areas, perhaps one near each major urban drug-using spot in North America and Europe. Why none of these had been found was a mystery. But the implication was, both publicly and no doubt under official wraps, that the SD agency, as the authorities arbitrarily termed it, had penetrated so far up into law enforcement groups, both local and national, that those who found out anything usable about its operations soon either didn't care or didn't exist. He had naturally several other leads at present besides Donna, other dealers he pressured progressively for larger quantities. But because she was his chick, or anyhow he had hopes in that direction, she was for him the easiest. Visiting her, talking to her on the phone, taking her out or having her over, that was a personal pleasure as well. It was, in a sense, the line of least resistance. If you had to spy on and report about someone, it might as well be people you'd see anyhow. That was less suspicious and less of a drag. And if you did not see them frequently before you began surveillance, you would have to eventually anyhow. They worked out the same in the end. Entering the phone booth, he did a phone thing. Ring, ring, ring. Hello, Donna said. Every pay phone in the world was tapped. Or if it wasn't, some crew somewhere had just gotten around to it. The taps fed electronically onto storage reels at a central point, and about once every second day a printout was obtained by an officer who listened to many phones without having to leave his office. He merely rang up the storage drums, and unsignaled, they played back, skipping all dead tape. Most calls were harmless. The officer could identify ones that weren't fairly readily. That was his skill. That was what he got paid for. Some officers were better at it than others. As he and Donna talked, therefore, no one was listening. The playback would come maybe the next day at the earliest. If they discussed anything strikingly illegal, and the monitoring officer caught it, then voice prints would be made. But all he and she had to do was keep it mild. The dialogue could still be recognizable as a dope deal. A certain governmental economy came into play here. It wasn't worth going through the hassle of voice prints and track down for routine illegal transactions. There were too many each day of the week, over too many phones. Both Donna and he knew this. "How you doing?" he asked. "Okay." Pause in her warm, husky voice. "How's your head today?" "Sort of in a bad space, sort of down." Pause. "I was bum-tripped this AM by my boss at the shop." Donna worked behind the counter of a little perfume shop in Gateside Mall in Costa Mesa, to which she drove every morning in her MG. "You know what he said? He said this customer, this old guy, gray hair, who bilked us out of $10, he said it was my fault and that I've got to make it good. It's coming out of my paycheck. So I'm out $10 through no fucking, excuse me, fault of my own." Arctor said, "Hey, can I get anything from you?" She sounded sullen now, as if she didn't want to, which was a shuck. "How much do you want? I don't know." 10 of them, he said. The way they had set it up, 1 was 100. This was a request for 1,000, then. Among fronts, if transactions had to take place over public communications, a fairly good try consisted of masking a large one by an apparently small one. They could deal and deal forever, in fact, in these quantities, without the authorities taking any interest. Otherwise, the narcotics teams would be raiding apartments and houses up and down each street each hour of the day, and achieving little. 10, Donna muttered irritably. I'm really hurting, he said like a user, rather than a dealer. I'll pay you back later, when I've scored. No, she said woodenly. I'll lay them on you gratis. 10. Now, undoubtedly, she was speculating whether he was dealing. Probably he was. 10. Why not? Say, 3 days from now? No sooner? These are... Okay, he said. I'll drop over. What time? She calculated. Say, around 8 in the p.m. Hey, I want to show you a book I got. Someone left it at the shop. It's cool. It has to do with wolves. You know what wolves do? The male wolf? When he defeats his foe, he doesn't snuff him, he pees on him. Really? He stands there and pees on his defeated foe, and then he splits. That's it. Territory is what they mostly fight over. And the right to screw, you know. Arctor said, I peed on some people a little while ago. No kidding? How come? Metaphorically, he said.
Not the usual way?
I mean, he said, I told him.
He broke off. Talking too much. A fuck up.
Jesus, he thought. These dudes, he said, like biker types. You dig around the Foster's Freeze? I was cruising by and they said something raunchy. So I turned around and I said something like... He couldn't think of anything for a moment.
You can tell me, Donna said.
Even if it's super gross. You gotta be super gross with biker types so they won't understand.
Arctor said,
I told him I'd rather ride a pig than a hog. Any time.
I don't get it.
Well, a pig is a chick that...
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, I got it.
Barf.
I'll see you at my place, like you said, he said. Bye.
He started to hang up.
Can I bring the wolf book and show you? It's by Conrad Lorenz. The back cover where they tell says he was the foremost authority on wolves on Earth. Oh, yeah, one more thing. Your roommates both came into the shop today, Ernie What's-His-Name and that Barris, looking for you, if you might have...
What about, Arctor said.
Your cephalochromoscope that cost you $900 that you always turn on and play when you get home. Ernie and Barris were babbling away about it. They tried to use it today and it wouldn't work. No colors and no ceph powders, neither one. So they got Barris' toolkit and unscrewed the bottom plate.
The hell you say, he said indignant.
And they say it's been fucked over, sabotaged, cut wires and, like, sort of weird stuff, you know? Freaky things. Shorts and broken parts. Barris said he'd tried it.
I'm going right home, Arctor said, and hung up.
My primo possession, he thought bitterly. And that fool Barris tinkering with it.
But I can't go home right now, he realized. I gotta go over to New Path and check on what they're up to.
It was his assignment. Mandatory.